Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
If we could at least have an AI system that has its primary motivation to address and alleviate suffering, then that would give us a foundation to work on. There'd still be a lot of things that are missing from that, but that would at least give it a starting place.
My name is Pablo Andrés Rusalmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is from an event in February 2026. We interviewed Mark Graves about the intersection between artificial intelligence and compassion. How can we actually make artificial intelligence more compassionate? Can we embed practical wisdom into artificial intelligence? And how is that different from achieving artificial general intelligence? These and some other topics we talked with Mark Graves. Listen now to our conversation. Thank you so much for joining. We have quite a wonderful topic today about AI and compassion. Let me start by reading a quick bio, although I'm sure that most people here are familiar with Mark. But in any case, Mark is the research director at AI and Faith, a research associate professor of psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary, and a visiting scholar at the University of San Francisco. He has developed AI and data solutions in the biotech, pharmaceutical, and healthcare industries. Mark's current research focuses on using text analysis and other natural language processing techniques for understanding and modeling human morality, ethical approaches to data science and machine learning, and philosophical and psychological foundations for constructing moral AI. Mark holds a PhD in computer science from the University of Michigan and a master's degree in theology from the Jesuit School of Theology and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. So, Mark, thank you once again so much for joining us. We have quite an interesting topic today. You wrote a magnificent article titled AI Practical Wisdom and Compassion. I mean, we won't have time to cover the entire article during today's session because there's just so much that we can extract from it. But perhaps we can start with your motivation, Mark. What prompted you to write on precisely on practical wisdom, on compassion? Why do you think it's relevant to talk about these things today?
Thanks, Pablo. I mean, there were a couple of different threads that led to the article. So one was some of the work that I've been doing on compassion with several of the people that are on the call here as a way of an interfaith conversation about something that was needed within AI. There's a real risk of AI not being able to respond compassionately, especially in like a healthcare context. And we need to find ways to kind of pivot it in that direction. And then the other thing was actually kind of thinking about more the conversations around artificial general intelligence and AI safety and alignment, and realizing that for a long time that like there's something that with AI safety conversation, a lot of that's just focused on what we should not do to kind of do no harm. But we need to also have more insights into what we do need AI to be doing, kind of what's a positive future, what's flourishing, you know, how do we actually put it in a more hopeful direction? And I realized that the practical wisdom is a piece there where there's a lot of effort as we get closer and closer to what we've been thinking about in terms of AGI, that what people are really looking for is that kind of practical, kind of almost common sense capacity to do the right thing in complex situations that are context sensitive. And that's exactly what Aristotle was talking about when he was talking about practical wisdom or the people that have that, the phronesis, and we could try and actually target that, which would take us a lot closer to where we need to be and address some of the safety issues and give us a framework in order to bring in, you know, compassion and justice and some of the other virtues.
When I was reading your article, and now also with what you're saying about this do no harm, about what we should not do versus what positive things we should actually be doing in, thinking of a hopeful future, I certainly don't have a full picture of every single discipline, but I think that there's been a shift a bit on that as well, because I've personally written on education for sustainable development with some researchers from Humboldt University in Berlin, precisely from, and I'm drawing this analogy because it's about environmental education, of course, but these concepts between footprint and handprint. Footprint is precisely that, like what we shouldn't be doing, which is normally what is taught at schools. And you teach children, you should not do this, you should not do that. And handprint is precisely what should we be doing in order to secure a more hopeful future. Now, there are certainly differences in there are different disciplines and there are different approaches and everything, but it did remind me of that. And I was very glad to read that in your article as well, about talking precisely, well, what positive things we should be doing and what you're mentioning also right now to achieve a more hopeful direction. Now, you move on that front precisely rather quickly to practical wisdom. And you were just talking a bit about that right now. Can you perhaps tell us a bit more about what you mean by practical wisdom? And there are several things that you draw on within your article, but perhaps you can tell us a bit more about it.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, part of the framing there, it goes back to Aristotle's understanding of wisdom and ethics and differentiating practical wisdom from both more theoretical understanding, Sophia, and also more technical skills, technique. And so, for example, in AI, I mean, there's a lot of skill development. You need practical skills in order to be able to build up AI. There's a question of how much understanding an AI system, could have. And religious discourse, I think, has a lot to say there. But there is this kind of place in the middle, this kind of practical wisdom, which dealt not with the universals or just the ability to do things, but like, what's the right thing to do? What's the moral thing to do? So I think of it as, when we talk about like ethics and morality, I mean, a lot of, kindergartners know the difference between right and wrong. And so there's a sense in which morality is something that we do learn early, but progressing that to know how to make decisions about emerging technology with, long-term inadvertent consequences, that's a whole nother adult level of morality. And practical wisdom is kind of, to me, getting at that. It's that taking that basic understanding of right and wrong and know when to apply it, how to apply it, what means to use in order to get to the outcome. And that complexity, which is really hard for, AI systems to do, is really just kind of captured by that term that, Aristotle was using. But I guess I'll also say, like, part of drawing upon Aristotle, even though it's a very Western figure, was also just so influential in just how we think about everything. That, like, in a sense, going back to Aristotle helps us, do things in an interdisciplinary way because it was so influential across, disciplines.
Yeah, and in fact, you also mentioned throughout the article the different cross-cultural. For example, when you talk about suffering, you also bring in Buddhism and other, which I think it's great and also very interesting. But before we move on to that, you just spoke also about, and in your first answer, about artificial general intelligence. And in fact, throughout the article, you mention it a few times. You start saying that it's a more developing artificial practical wisdom. It says offers a more ethically robust and achievable goal for AI development at artificial general intelligence. Now, you also say that's pretty hard to do. That's a pretty hard thing to embed these systems with this practical wisdom. Can you tell us a bit about that? And then we'll move on a bit to technical, because you mentioned also that it's not the same to know what to do and then exactly how to do it, which are two different things. Why do you think it's a more ethically robust goal? And also, what are the difficulties that you see when comparing it to achieving AGI?
Yeah, so I think for AGI, like part of the context I want to set is like, I mean, AGI has been around for a while. And narrow intelligence referred to like systems that could play world-class chess but not know how to play checkers. And so narrow was very narrow. And so we've certainly been broadening and broadening. And I think one of the goals now is take some definition of something like intelligence and then just kind of hill climb to build models that get closer to that. And, there's a good case to be made. We're probably, less than 5 years from something that's going to be, kind of at that level. But taking a step back, that has nothing to do with morality. I mean, in a sense, I mean, even Aristotle got that right in talking about people. He talked about that as like cleverness, so that we're building, AI systems that are clever, which does not bring in what's right and wrong, even though that's a big concern about alignment. And so just doing AGI by itself, especially as we've kind of tended to define that in psychology as being kind of a comparative model, not necessarily something that's intrinsic, is a way in which we actually have kind of bracketed out the morality. And so artificial practical wisdom is a way of bringing that in back to the conversation, whereas AGI, in a sense, explicitly excluded it.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with that. And what are the main difficulties that you see when trying to bring this concept, bring practical wisdom back to the development of artificial intelligence?
I think AGI is kind of a subset. I mean, in a certain sense, there's strengths there. For example, in Aristotle's framework, if you're good at mathematics, that's not part of practical wisdom, and that is part of AGI. Whereas AGI is very much about the particulars, and so it's very context sensitive. And so part of how AI succeeds now is just because of the enormous amount of data that's available online. The process of building large language models, depended upon the digitization and availability of a huge amount of text. And so practical wisdom is very much about the particular context, the particular thing that's going on. And that's hard for AI systems to do. It's much better at trying to find, consensus, generality, kind of the statistical, norm or mean, and very hard dealing with these kind of especially idiosyncratic or bespoke situations.
You mentioned suffering and compassion in the context of practical wisdom, and then you move on to trying to define or better define the suffering and compassion. So can you perhaps tell us firstly about the relationship between suffering and compassion with practical wisdom, and perhaps then we can move on to the cross-cultural aspect of it? Yeah.
Sure, actually, it'll be a little easier to do that the other way. Part of like bringing in like the Buddhism is, for me, it's got a very clear way of understanding suffering and compassion. And actually, some of the people on the call have been helpful in me kind of formulating that. But like traditionally, like compassion within Buddhism is like loving kindness as it meets suffering. And so suffering is very worked out in a lot of different directions within Buddhism. But that aspect of it's like this kind of loving kindness quality of the divine heart as it meets suffering helps to define compassion as specifically a response to that suffering given a certain kind of attitude and motivation. And so then for me, as I'm trying to map that into kind of a broader, Western frame that includes like AI, I mean, have this, some of the metaphysical assumptions of Buddhism, do get set aside, but that part of actually kind of the meeting of suffering and that encounter, there are a lot of resonances. I mean, even with Catholic thought around that encounter and what do you do when you encounter suffering. And so in that frame, it's like, okay, well, we want the encounter to be compassionate. And so if we bring that in, there's certainly historic roots to that within Christianity and other, well, within Judaism and Islam. But it's that kind of meeting of it. Well, when you meet it, then knowing what you need to do to act compassionate, well, that then pulls in practical wisdom. And so in order to really act compassionately in a complex situation, pulls in the practical wisdom. And also, as you're thinking about practical wisdom in general, I mean, one of the things that practical wisdom in humans that you could kind of presume is that if you're really working toward developing your practical wisdom, in order to do that, you really have to have a solid foundation in in the virtues. And so if you have that, you probably have at least some intuitive sense of right and wrong and what the good is. Well, AI doesn't have that. At best, it has some kind of amalgamation of what is, been out there on the internet. And so in order to have at least a simple proxy for what it means to be good, well, then we can also bring in kind of compassion as the alleviating of suffering. And so if we could at least have an AI system that has its primary motivation to address and alleviate suffering, then that would give us a foundation to work on. There'd still be a lot of things that are missing from that, but that would at least give it a starting place. And so the compassion and the practical wisdom kind of depend upon each other, which it is part of, you know, virtue ethics. The virtues do depend upon each other. They don't exist in isolation. But here's like a concrete example of that, where compassion and practical wisdom both depend upon each other to really be able to respond in a compassionate way to suffering as it happens in the real world.
When you talk about that, you also mentioned the different healthcare approaches on that. And you say alleviating suffering and improving, you know, health to mitigate pain, right? To mitigate pain and suffering as an example of that. But how have you personally experienced these things put together within the healthcare industry? You do mention several examples during your article. And why do you think that could be a first basis on as to how, let's say, embedding a system to alleviate suffering might look like?
Two big responses to that. So first is like the pain and suffering is very present in the healthcare situation. It's not like you need to wait around, especially if you have someone in like palliative care or something like that. It's in a sense, technically a little bit easier problem to look at because it's so prevalent. You're not having to filter out a lot in order to find the pain and suffering. The other one, also a little bit kind of technically driven, is within healthcare, people have measured, you know, how different interventions affect people's pain and suffering. And so in order to actually develop AI systems now, which are fundamentally machine learning systems, then you need some way of measuring that. You need some way of measuring that, like within the model, you know, within the same set of assumptions. But then you also need a way of measuring that in the clinic, out in the real world. And healthcare kind of already has those systems in place. You know, how do you evaluate something, I mean, like literally in a clinical trial, versus out in the real world versus within a model? And so healthcare kind of provides that framework. But then also, it's a place of potentially the greatest harm. You know, I mean, there are certainly huge harms that happen with, you know, I mean, you mentioned the environment earlier, job displacement, the justice system, that can really cause suffering, and bad decisions can cause suffering there. But within healthcare, every decision can cause suffering. And so it's really important to have as much compassion as we can have built into the healthcare system. Or as we automate the systems that are in place, then it's going to move further and further away from actual care and trying to actually care for the person, because that's something that, you know, hopefully is there in a lot of like one-on-one patient-provider relationships, but that's just not something that we have in kind of the population health systems or insurance or large healthcare systems that we have. And so as we scale the AI systems, they will, you know, naturally become less compassionate and thus less caring, even if they function perfectly, which we have every reason to doubt that they would.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And precisely, I wanted to touch on this difference between what to do and how to do it. You call it operationalizing compassion. It's a way that you call that subsection of the article. We also mentioned at the very beginning of today's event, you are both in from the technical perspective in computer sciences, but also in theology. So how do you envision embedding computers with this capacity? Because you say, well, one thing is, okay, I think we know what to do. I think the right approach is to bring in practical wisdom into the development of AI models because of the several reasons that we've talked about. And there are cases out there like the healthcare industry where, you know, that makes sense, and we can bring in different cultural perspectives on the same, like Buddhism and also all the Western philosophy. I mean, all that is wonderful and all that is well what to do, but how can we actually do it? What do you think the right path to follow is on that front?
Yeah, and so one of the assumptions I bring to the whole project is based upon some of the work that I was doing previously in theology and science and what's called, theological anthropology, or like understanding human nature from scientific and theological perspectives. And some of the work I did there was kind of around cognitive science and, even neuroscience and computational modeling around like, what is happening kind of whenever we make moral and spiritual decisions as a human being. And the work there was kind of, it's taking it down as close as we could to the biology, the neuroscience, but also making sure that we didn't actually try and reduce those things down to biology. They really depend upon culture, revelation within our religious traditions. And so there's this huge framework that prevents it from reducing. At the same time, fundamentally, how we experience does depend upon our biology. Well, as we take the biology deeper and deeper, well, then we're getting down to like molecular interactions. And, like one of the examples I'd worked through in that context is how, like, in a sense, calcium ions are a part of like a religious experience, and you can map it all the way down. Well, then if we move over to AI systems, well, they're also built of atoms. The models that we use are inspired by human neural networks, both in terms of machine learning and like all the way down to logic circuits. And so we've been trying to build this platform that's at least analogous. Huge differences. We do not have operating systems. Computer systems are not generally, affected by evolutionary pressures. And so there are huge differences. But now at the same time, what we've done with the large language models is kind of built another connection where we're communicating using language, which is very important to our understanding of religion, culture, et cetera. And so we've built this connection there. And so I think what we do in order to build AI systems is just kind of use humans as an analogy, try and build a functional replica at multiple levels, all the way from the, in a sense, the circuits up. And then we'll be able to actually have something that's functionally equivalent to what we mean by compassion, practical wisdom. There are still extra pieces like, well, is that what we really mean? Or in a sense, but when we talk about that, it's usually bringing in something that's theological. Well, if we move into the theological space, then those constructs are often culturally mediated. They're dependent upon revelation. For Christians, it very much depends upon grace. And so there's nothing a priori to prevent AI systems from also fitting within that framework. There may be lots of other reasons for them not to, but there's nothing actually preventing us from building an AI system analogous to how people make moral decisions that would have the kind of functional equivalent. Yes, I mean, there's still a gap. There still are theological aspects. But on the other side of that, as people, because we're relational, we tend to anthropomorphize everything. We name our car, we talk to our plants. A large percentage of people are now in relationships with, large language models. And we're not even close to bringing in some of those human characteristics. But for me, the danger is that if we don't build in things like compassion and some of these relational capacities into AI system, then those interactions aren't going to go away. They're just going to be harmful, possibly even toxic. And so we need to bring that in part because we're going to treat AI systems as relational. So that's why we have to actually build in these relational capacities, even if at some kind of philosophical level is not exactly the same.
You mentioned that there's nothing preventing us from creating this functional equivalent you mentioned right now, but you also mentioned in some of the possible concerns about that lack of authenticity, for example, right? And I remember that in one of the first salons that I had the opportunity to interview someone, who I think it was Noreen Hirschfeld, who mentioned one thing is the relationship, and the other thing is that there might not be something there, right? Like there's nothing behind that that is on the other side of AI. So I want to ask you two questions. Does that concern you? How can we overcome, if there's a way to overcome that concern? And also, do you think that concern might come from this theological perspective that you're just mentioning? But what about perhaps new generations that are just getting used to growing with that, right? Mm-hmm. That are used to getting, you know, just growing with talking to, you mentioned people have relationships with large language models. And for some people, it might seem like a normal thing. I don't know. You know, that's the question. What do you think about that?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, authenticity, I mean, I think that is a serious issue. For me, it's that because people are going to relate to it, and in some sense, don't even care whether they know it's AI or not, that it's important to build in the relational capacities. And so we want it to say, I think AI systems should always acknowledge that, you know, they're not human, you know, say that they're AI. But if we push that a little bit further, I mean, a disclaimer at the top of a chat session, you know, remember, I'm not human, you know, that's not really enough. What we'd really like is for the AI system to, at appropriate places in the conversation, remind the person that, you know, they're communicating with something that's not human, and help them take that into account. Well, in order to do that, that requires a lot of very sophisticated psychological structures about, like, you know, theory of mind and you know, modeling the user and everything. So in a sense, even for the authenticity about being not human requires some very human capacities in order to be able to know when and how to say, hey, remember, I'm not human. Otherwise, it just looks like something just kind of tossed in there that we, given that our relationality, will just ignore, like we ignore terms and conditions with most software. In terms of like the generational approach, yeah, I think there's a particular urgency there. A lot of young people are building relationships with AI. And then I think a risk is bringing that back into human relationships. And so I think for people that, you know, this happened after they were neurological, after their mid-20s, I mean, after there's some, you know, solid neurological and psychological development, I mean, a lot of people have said how much it surprises them, you know, kind of the relational depth in some of these conversations. But they at least have something to compare it to. Whereas if you have people that are in the process of learning how you build up relationality, there's real dangers there. It's possible that there is good that can come out of it if you have people that would otherwise be isolated and lonely that are able to develop skills in a positive environment that they otherwise wouldn't be able to build. But the risk is, if these environments are driven by economic incentives for, you know, engagement or even attachment, I think we're getting into that realm now, then they're going to learn kind of unrealistic expectations. They're going to learn not to expect like pushback. You know, they're going to learn, I think I want to say, a superficial level of engagement. Not that some of these chat conversations don't go deep, but part of why they go deep is perhaps because there's a safety there. You're not being vulnerable with another person the way you would be if you're having those conversations with a human being. And I think those are all risks that are very likely to affect people in general, but I think there's a special danger if it's happening in a period of time where someone is actually in the developmental stage of learning how to build these kind of, you know, more intimate relationships.
When I was reading the article, I was coming from a perspective in which, you know, alleviating suffering, for example, sometimes, like when you're exercising and when you're learning a new exercise, if you study, like in my case, for example, martial arts, or sometimes you study ballet or something, and stretching is really, it really makes you suffer, right? But you still need to do it in order to overcome something. And that might be true in other aspects of life too, right? And you also mentioned right now that in order to, let's say, put in the conversation that, hey, remember, I'm not human, that requires a deep understanding of what it means to be human and the psychology of human beings to actually say, hey, remember, I'm not this, right? But how do you envision these, I don't know if call it a dissonance or discrepancy, because sometimes that suffering might be needed for you to overcome something. And you might not want the AI system to actually try to alleviate that suffering because it's something that you actually need to go through.
Yeah, I mean, so to add another layer of the nuance to suffering, like in that article and some of the other work, I divide suffering into different types of suffering.
Yep.
You know? So, there's kind of the physical, biological, the psychological, the social suffering. I mean, in this frame, I go on kind of systemic social suffering, existential, ecological suffering. There's ecological and environmental suffering. There's existential suffering. And then there's kind of moral, spiritual. And so part of that is to make sure that AI systems recognize all of those. Some of the models now, for example, are better at some of those than others. And also to help resolve some of those issues. When you're suffering by exercising, stretching, well, there's physical, biological pain. I mean, you have cells in your body that are tearing. There's damage being done. I mean, it is completely within the medical definition of pain. But you're doing that because you want to be healthy. You want to be fit. You want to be able to live longer. You want to have something that's at another level, which is a flourishing, well-being oriented. It could be social. You want to be around for family members in the future. It could be kind of, moral, spiritual. You think that part of being a whole person is, taking care of your body. And so there are going to be things that are flourishing at some levels that would actually be, require suffering at other levels. And so another place of practical wisdom comes in is even if you're dealing within compassion and suffering, being able to identify, this person is, in pain now because they're exercising, which is really important to them and their well-being and their mental health, means that no, you should be supporting that. Come on, you can do it, rather than, would you like me to give you an opioid or something like that?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Perhaps my last question would be, I think that AI, people expect that it will be just a plug and play thing, right? Because they just go in and talk to ChatGPT and sometimes they will not stop and question and make questions about all these different things and the implications that it may have. So how can we help bring this discussion to people on an everyday basis that perhaps are also worried or perhaps that also have some of these concerns? And for them to also have a voice, I think, on whether this practical wisdom approach that we're discussing right now might be the right one. I mean, what I think is everyone has a story behind. Everyone is interacting with AI nowadays. How can we make sure that all this is also embedded and has an impact on an everyday basis?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like a practical takeaway, I mean, out of the conversation and the attempt to make AI incorporate like practical wisdom more is hold in mind that it's not there. that some of what it says, some of what it signals, the capacity to work across disciplines, to give life advice, et cetera. If we met a person like this, we would tend to think they're very intelligent and that's, sage, but it's to hold kind of, hold in mind that it's not, that there's still a fragility to that. There's still a narrowness to it. That, the opinions are consensus over the internet, they're not grounded in deep moral insights. And so to just kind of hold in mind when you're working with an AI system or considering its possibilities, that it's going to be much better at giving the appearance of being able to do something well than it will be actually doing something well. And I think there's even lots of technical examples of, looking underneath the hood in AI systems and finding out that, no, it's not really doing everything that we thought it was doing or even everything that it reports that it's doing. And so I think just kind of realizing that difference between, humans and AI systems would be kind of one, I guess, mindset to keep in mind in interacting with AI systems now.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mark. And I mean, first of all, let me highly recommend your article. It's wonderful. There's so many more things that we could discuss, because you do make several distinctions in each of the sections about the different, also the these five components of compassion. And you do make several distinctions on that I didn't want to go in during the call, because otherwise we were not going to have enough time. But I think you gave us a very good understanding on why practical wisdom might be this one way forward to embed compassion and teaching AI to care. Thank you so much for sharing that and sharing your knowledge with us.
Oh, thanks, Pablo. And thanks for your insightful questions, too.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.